Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Ho in the Know, a podcast by sex workers for sex workers, all about sex work. Also, I was watching TikTok and somebody was doing a report on essentially like how sex workers are probably going to get locked out of crypto, and they called us spicy workers. And I was like, I actually love that. I'm a spicy worker. But yeah, so I am Hard Titty Selena. Corey knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I am deep in PMDD land. My tits are so hard. They feel like they're fake. They look a little bit fake, but they're homegrown and full of cysts. So that's me right now.
And I'm homegrown and full of cysts. Corey.
And we are joined today by Dominique F. Triggs.
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Every episode, we begin with a segment we call Historical Hoes. And this week's historical hoe is Nell Gwynn. Nell Gwynn was born Eleanor Gwynn in either 1642 or 1650 to lowborn parents somewhere in the UK. Her mother ran a brothel and her father was a sea captain who didn't stick around to raise his two daughters. At the brothel, Nell would perform skits and soon developed a name as being quite an accomplished actress with incredible comedic timing and wit, famously experimenting with cross-dressing, going under the name William Nell, and adopting a false beard. Patrons would come to the brothel just to see her perform, even though at the time women were not allowed on the stage. When Cromwell came into rule in England, all theater performances were banned as they were considered frivolous. Charles II soon ascended to the throne and the laws once again changed, legalizing acting for women. And so the Theatre Royal on Drury Lane was built and Nell was given a job as a sweet seller. Orange Moll, a former sex worker and a friend of Madame Gwynn's, hired Nell and her older sister Rose as a scantily clad orange girl, selling the small, sweet china oranges to the audience inside the theater. The work exposed Nell to multiple aspects of theater life and to London's higher society, and Charles frequently attended performances. The orange girls would also serve as messengers between men in the audience and actresses backstage. They received monetary tips for this role, and some of these messages would end in sexual assignments. However, Nell's clear, strong voice, cleverness, and good looks meant she was soon being trained as an actress, and in 1665, she was one of England's favorites and gained celebrity status. When the Great Plague of London shut down the theater, Nell and her sister started following the King's court around the country. During one performance, Nell was seated in the box next to King Charles. Even though Charles already had several mistresses and a wife, the two fell in love and the other mistresses were dismissed. Nell gave birth to her first son in 1670. She still continued to perform on stage, much to the horror of society who deemed it beneath her. The king purchased Nell her own townhouse, and she gave birth to another son in 1671. When King Charles died in 1685, his heir, James II, gave Nell an annual pension and allowed her to retire into obscurity. In 1678, at the age of 37, Nell had a stroke and died, almost certainly due to the acquired variety of syphilis. It's pretty wild to think that she retired into obscurity before 37 and that was normal, but you know what? That's the life and times living in the 1600s. Anyway, and that is the life and times, the short life and times of Nell Gwynn, this week's historical hoe.
We also have a dog here,
yeah,
my dog.
We do.
And so if you hear some panting, you know, some jingle jangle collar, that's what's up.
It's a very adorable black and white multi.
Very on brand.
Yes.
Yes.
So primarily do you do burlesque?
Yes, primarily I do burlesque. That's actually where my persona kind of came about originally, because I actually didn't get into more like BDSM and things until I got into burlesque. I mean, I guess I was kind of into it, but then it was more, I don't know, like it exploded. I had like a community and things to explore and talk about things with until I got into burlesque.
Yeah.
And so how did you get into burlesque? How did you find the world of burlesque, and who was like, did you have any kind of mentorship getting into it? What was like the first burlesque thing that caught your eye?
Well, actually, that's kind of two separate stories. The first time burlesque actually caught my eye, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. So this whole kind of world wasn't something that I grew up around. But I went to a kind of queer-friendly bar, and they were doing a kind of drag show slash burlesque show. And there was this, I guess, man, I want to say, who came out, and he was like in what do you call it, we used to call them wife beaters, but I know that's a terrible, terrible name.
An A-shirt,
for
yeah.
The shirt. An A-shirt, yes. And these baggy jeans, and they came out and stripped everything down, and then once they came down to their boxers, they pulled an apple out of their underwear and took a bite. Ugh. And I just remember I have that image in my head, and I was just like, oh, this is amazing. I don't know what this is, but this is amazing. So that's my first like thought or first connection or first time it caught my eye. But I grew up in a world of performance. I came from African dance, and I perform on stage a lot. So I kind of was used to the stage energy. But actually, I was doing a bunch of stage shows, theater shows, and a lighting director was like, hey, I'm lighting a burlesque show. And the girl had a dropout. This looks like something you could do.
Oh.
And I was like, okay, I'll give it a try.
That's like, that's intense that they were just like, just go for it, you know? Like, because, burlesque is so elaborate and theatrical. It's like people have like a whole narrative that they're bringing to the stage, and props and costume changes and tearaways.
Well, of course, that was something that, exactly. Of course, that wasn't something that he knew. It's just like, oh, I just show up and light stuff. But
oh, so he was just like, I did the lights here. Mm-hmm. Let's just see what happens.
I don't know. I think he was just like, oh, sexy girl. You're a sexy girl. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
You probably sexy. Right.
Yeah.
What was that first show? Oh,
no, go ahead. I was going to say the show was a take on Alice in Wonderland. It was called Painting the Roses Red. And I got to play the White Rabbit and the Red Queen, which was crazy.
Two big parts.
For the show, right? I was so overwhelmed. But the woman who was putting it on, the producer and also a burlesque artist, she, I don't know if she trusted me or she was just like, I don't have a choice. But I played both parts, and after that run of the show, she was like, you're hosting all my shows.
Oh my gosh. She was like, the show must go on. It was truly the show must go on moment. And you really made that show. That's incredible. Honestly, very ambitious start.
Mm-hmm. And so go ahead.
I was saying I came from that kind of show presence, so I believe that's what I had. The only thing I had to overcome was the getting undressed in front of other people. And that was the thrilling, like, I don't know how to describe that feeling when you do it and you're just kind of like out of breath, like panting in front of an audience. And you're like, wow, this is exhilarating.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, definitely. I mean, how was your body? Like, did you feel like you were prepared? Like, did you feel like, oh man, I should have groomed a certain way, or what?
Definitely. I honestly don't think I was. Like, of course I was like, okay, let me shave this up or shave that up. But then when you get, you know, backstage or something, you're like, oh man, did I miss a spot? Or like, oh, does this look okay? Should I have moisturized more or something like that?
The moisture, moisture.
And that's always something I came obsessed with afterward, which is lighting.
Did you get asked to do other shows after that through that show? Like, did people just come up to you and ask you, or did you seek out shows to, or a little bit of both?
Immediately after, I just kind of stayed with my producer slash, I even call her my burlesque mama, Sally Sincere. She was the person who, to piggyback on to your last question, like my mentor, who knew about the world of burlesque. So she knew about the whole like commitment that it takes, costume, narrative, what you're trying to bring to the story. And she kind of like showed me that and exposed me to all of that and learned me a good thing or two.
Wow, that's so cool. I mean, so there, to me, I see burlesque as like kind of having like a bit of a, like a cost tab, you know, like props are not expensive or not cheap. If, even if it's like, you know, money cheap, it's not time cheap. It's like either you're DIYing something like ridiculous or you're putting in the money to do it. How do you like craft your burlesque acts?
Well, that's a great question. Because honestly, some of the, I'm what you call like a neo burlesque artist. So I don't really, or I don't do as much as the rhinestoning and the garter belts and things like that. Like I have a few of that, but people make the joke of like, we're just kind of the ones that kind of roll out and, in, you know, sweatpants, and we just strip out of anything. Effortless, less where we're like, oh, this is my favorite onesie. I'm going to strip slowly out of this onesie in front of you. but when you bring the narrative part and you want to tell a story, then it gets more costly because it's like, oh, I want to bring this giant thing out of the sky. And then I want to, you know, explode and poof and be somewhere else. I don't know. You just, all this crazy stuff. But that's the whole, kind of bartering with yourself. As in like, do I have the time? Do I have the money? You kind of save up. You try to do shows which are like lower cost to invest in yourself because you want to tell this story, but you want to have the right things for it. But that's when you get you have to get a little crafty. You got to be a little hustler
to try to. Yeah, you got to pull out your hot glue gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hot glue. Sometimes I can be a little klepto with my friends. I'm like, ooh, this would be perfect. You don't need this, right? Let me just take that.
Valid. Valid.
Yeah. I've stolen so much makeup.
Oh, same. I used to be a real menace to my Rite Aid and shit as a young person.
Yeah. You got into BDSM as well. When did that start to happen in your journey? I know you said you did it a little bit before, but where did that come into play?
Well, once we started doing more shows at different venues, we started meeting other burlesque artists. And I think around that time we met Betty Bondage. And she's like a big name in the LA not burlesque, well also burlesque, but also BDSM scene. And we got to, I don't know, learn all these different techniques, and we would meet up sometimes to whip and go over fire, and she would show us these different techniques for flogging, and we just got to meet all these new people who were heavy and knew a lot more about it than I did. And that's when we started attending events, and I had friends who were also queer and also into BDSM, and so it became like a part of our life. And oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess it wasn't too long after I got into burlesque, maybe like a year or so after. Mm-hmm. But I mean, because early on in the burlesque, I had to pick a name. And my burlesque wonder, Sally Sincere, was like, well, pick something that's important to you or pick something that, you know, speaks to you. And I used to read this book when I was younger called The Fountainhead, and there was this character in there named Dominique, who I really spoke with. And she was like troubled, but she was always right. And so I liked Dominique, but I was like, well, I don't know what my last name will be. And so I knew that BDSM and all this, especially like femdoming, was a part of my personality, and I thought that's what I do when I'm on stage. And so that's why I came up with Tricks as like a little kitschy last name, as in, well, yes, I'm gonna dominate you. My name is Dominique Tricks.
Oh, cute.
Yeah. So did you start, after you started getting into BDSM more, did you start, you started to incorporate more of that into your act, and like, what did that look like?
Yes, I did. BDSM took more of a hold on me in my personal life as well, as far as like having different partners and finding different things that we like to explore. But when it came to my acts, it would definitely change the costume or the sound or how I dealt with the audience, because I even think that there was a lot more people in our audience who we discovered was into it, or we turned on to it from the way that we, because we love audience participation. We love kind of pushing the boundaries and I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. How have you sort of translated your acts onto online? Because I know that sort of the scene has been disrupted by COVID, and you've been doing more online stuff.
Have you transitioned?
Well, it was kind of difficult at first because, like I was saying, I'm used to the stage, and so you kind of want to be big and grand, but when you see it back, you realize it doesn't have the same impact. It doesn't look the same. It doesn't feel the same as, you know, being live in front. But honestly, being online can open up a different avenue to performance. And it's just kind of like, you know, acting for stage versus acting for screen is where you kind of have to, you have to play with a laser, because what your audience is literally just a blip on your, in your computer, a blip on your phone.
Yeah.
And you can do different illusions.
What are you streaming it on? Are you streaming, or how are you doing it? Pre-recording?
Oh, no. Well, we do pre-recordings and lives. So we do it live as well on Zoom and another one, but I can't remember off the top of my head. Because we really like the live aspect with some of the people that I perform with, because there are quite a few shows who are that are online right now.
Yeah, I wonder, like, have you seen people move back online more since, like, the Omicron variant kind of, started ravaging the world?
Well, yes, because earlier, or I guess the end of last year, we were moving kind of back into in-person, and we were all excited. We finally got to meet some of the burlesque artists that we were performing with online. And we were like, oh, maybe online is dead now. But there were some shows that were still continuing. But it went from like, you know, 20 shows down to 5 online shows. Then when it picked back up again, it was like, okay, I guess we're picking back up, because a lot of our audience expressed that they were uncomfortable with the in-person kind of thing. So they're like, okay, we'll bring the sexiness to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely like a bit of a time where people are on the fence about going out. I mean, I was talking to like one of my regulars who went out to Vegas for business, and I mean, he was just saying that Vegas is dead right now. like, which is just crazy to
really
think about. Yeah. It's just like nightlife is kind of on hold this month. I don't know. Hopefully it, I mean, I don't know. I think it'll come back in February, but it's just, I don't know. Like, people are very cautious right now.
As they should be.
As they should be.
Yeah, it's been a while with a lot of people leaving us. And I guess maybe only now people are getting it, because very, like, right in the middle of it, people were still, like, hard, heavy, going out and doing stuff. And I was like, what the hell are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you do also, you do like group burlesque, or like storytelling burlesque with other people. Is that the case?
Well, I guess so. I mean, it sounds different when you say group burlesque versus like a troupe. I guess so, because we rehearse and we bring together and do like duets, or, you know, triplets or something of a song where we, because yes, I mean, honestly, all of it to me is storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know if I really feel the need to get on stage if I'm not being a character or telling a story or being something specific that can kind of reach people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, oftentimes in duets, we tell a story of love or love lost, or, you know, something as simple as, I hate you, I'm going to steal your dress, and now you're naked, you know,
mm-hmm.
like anything. But no, it definitely brings that community together.
Yeah. I mean, it's really cool to like have an art form like this, where you are working so closely together, and it's like an intimate art form, and it's, everybody gets sexy together.
Do you feel like you're a part, like, I know maybe there's like a conversation within the sex worker community about like where burlesque falls and like the horocracy and like, you know, that are, you know, you're stripping, like you are stripping. But I guess there's not the element of like a strip club. There's not the element of maybe getting completely naked
or catering to like a customers, I guess. Like, there is catering to customers, but it's not like it, as much intimate contact with customers, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you feel like you define yourself as a sex worker?
Yes. Yes, I do. I mean, especially with, honestly, because we've gone online so much and kind of like learned how to monetize ourselves even more, kind of like, because a lot of people even commission us for, you know, personal acts or things like that. And I believe it is sex work. It is under that umbrella, because I don't know, to be a burlesque artist and know that you're stripping, it kind of, I don't know, kind of feels like you're trying to poo-poo on anyone else who also considers himself a sex worker. Like, yes, I do that, but I'm a little better. And I don't know if I believe that. It's just the aspect of it that makes me happy. Like, that's a part of it that I enjoy. Because I get to, I don't know, add a little art, I guess, to it or something. But I can't even say that, because even the regular strippers in the Quillette Club, they do amazing things.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of artfulness in stripping at the club, for sure. I mean, I think it can vary, though, because, you know, a lot of times it is just like straight, you know, catering to people, like with a lap dance or whatever, like private dances or, you know, hand jobs and shit, whatever your stripping career might look like. So how would you define sex work?
That's a good question. It's selling sex in any form, because it's like a fantasy involved, especially with the burlesque aspect. But it's the idea of it. It's the, or even the physical act. It's, to me, sex work is just, it's selling sex, selling that sensuality, that connection, that whatever you kind of think of sex as, or what the benefits of it is. I think it's a good way, the benefits of what sex is. That's what you're selling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why do you think sex workers like might exclude burlesque from the umbrella? Like some sex workers, not to say that.
No, not us. Yeah. Well, not me.
They might exclude it because usually we don't have sex with our audience or with our clients, but I think it just, I guess, depends on that particular artist or what they're willing to do or not do. Because when you were talking about lap dance and something, I was like, well, I mean, I was talking about audience participation where we kind of, you know, touch them or bully them, or we might even take off their clothes or like, you know, lay on them as we do a long little kickback or something. And maybe it's not clapping cheeks in their face, but it's connecting with them and trying to give them a little taste, a little pleasure or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also kind of like if we add like people who do like erotic photography and stuff, you know, and, or people who mm-hmm. do like, I don't know, stuff like that, where there isn't even direct physical contact with, you know, clients.
And like if you direct porn or like.
Yeah, if you direct porn.
Yeah,
or,
if you're talking doing photography, I'm like, yeah, isn't that under porn-ish to me? Like, isn't that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like for sexual consumption and like mm-hmm. there is definitely mm-hmm. like, I think that, you know, people kind of can take burlesque in two ways. Like one mm-hmm. can be like the erotic place, but I think there's also like the campy theatrical place that it can be too. Like it lives mm-hmm. in both of those worlds.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because it came from the vaudeville kind of cabaret origins, where they're like, you know, making jokes and being cheeky and all that stuff. So yeah, I get that, but I mean, if you're, especially what it's come to today and like how, I don't know, people have less taboo over sex or sex work, then I don't know, I feel like it's kind of shifting more into that.
How would you define like the new generation of burlesque and from the old generation?
Oh. I think it's less showgirl. That's why I was talking about, I'm from the neo burlesque generation where, I think it is a bit more storytelling. It is a bit more like, I'm just a regular girl like you. I'm just being sensual today kind of feel. Mm-hmm. Like I was talking about like stripping out of, you know, sweatshirts and a onesie, because that's something that your audience would wear. That's something that you're kind of connecting with them and kind of showing that everyone is sexual or everyone is sensual. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine is going through some mental health issues, and she came up with a hospital gown and was, you know, ripping apart her hospital tag. And that kind of thing is like beautiful. And I love the art part of it. And the, so for to me, burlesque is nowadays is a bit more storytelling, a bit more about the common man instead of the one, you know, the showgirl dressed up in rhinestones and very shiny and all that stuff. I think it's less shiny. It's more real.
Mm-hmm. When do you think that shift started to happen? Because I know when I became conscious of burlesque, it was very like Dita Von Teese and people like that who, you know, it was this big production focused on one person mostly, and mm-hmm. like, you know, rhinestones, martini glass.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or even the movie Showgirls and like, you know, that being a reference for burlesque or like, you know, stage stripping. Yeah. When do you think that shift started to happen?
Honestly, I mean, yeah, I think the shift did happen very recently because, I mean, I remember that, and I didn't discover that burlesque could be this other thing until I got to LA, until I was in The Roses Are Red, or I guess even when I saw my first taste of burlesque, where they pulled the apple out of their boxers. But I don't know if you're talking about a particular time. I don't know. I mean, I want to say maybe like in the last 7-ish years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it was like the rhinestone and things was a big thing recently, but now you're seeing all these artists pop up that are a bit more accessible, I think.
So you do a show called, oh my God, it's a Shakespearean show.
Oh yeah.
How did that come into your life? And I think you do drag in that show as well.
Yeah. I guess to me it also comes from that performance aspect or the storytelling aspect of burlesque. But that company, that group, the producer for that, is definitely like a Shakespeare head. She's a, you know, bibliophile, and it's about bringing that sexy aspect to something that you already know. So it's like storytelling, but in a different way, which is what I've thinking, you know, the whole neo-burlesque is kind of going to. And I got into it because she came to one of our, the group that I was originally in, Zip, she came to one of our shows, and she, I guess, identified with the us kind of telling that common story or being more accessible. And I was the host for that show because Sally wanted me to host all her shows. And she was like, well, obviously you can speak, you can talk to the audience, because a lot of people, a lot of dancers and stuff, they don't, you know, talk very much. They're just like, I'm just here to dance, you know, watch me work. But a lot of them don't like talk. And even a lot of my burlesque friends that I had way back then, they were like, I don't like it when people talk to me. They were just like, I just want to get up and dance and then, you know, go home. Hmm. And, you know, I'll receive the accolades, but I don't want to talk back. And they would like use me as their talking person when we would go out to the audience. But I'm getting off the topic. Well, she saw me at the show and she was like, you know, obviously you could speak, but you do burlesque. I have this little thing that I'm doing. Is this something you'd be interested in? She only had like 5 main players at the time, and I think most of them were guys. But she wanted to include more ladies who could do Shakespeare. And I auditioned for her because she wanted to make sure that she can do the Shakespeare text because all of it is Shakespeare, and the rest is history. I did study Shakespeare when I was younger in school and things like that, so I knew about it, but it was something that was a new challenge, something that was more learning, so I was very, very interested.
So are you like using an actual Shakespearean script, or are you is there like an adaptation that's like modernized?
Oh yeah, definitely. We definitely adapted because all of our shows would be like, you know, 3 or 4 hours long if we were using the exact text. But most of it, most of the script is pulled straight from the book. We just like omitted a line or two to make the line quicker so that we can kind of focus on the meat of each text, because we want to make our shows more, because some people can listen to Shakespeare and be like, I have no idea what they're saying. So we adapted so that a regular person who hasn't listened to Shakespeare before can get it. But we do leave the opportunity to, like you were talking about me doing drag and things like that, because a lot of the characters are male, but a lot of the group now is female. So, so it's kind of, I can see how it is kind of back to that vaudeville kind of cabaret kitschy thing, because a lot of us do play guys, and so kind of poking fun at that is why I was decided, I was like, oh, I'm gonna wear my strap on because I'm playing a man.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, like, how do you embody that masculinity and yeah, show up as a masculine person?
Well, I think me personally, I grew up as a tomboy. So the whole glitz and glam of burlesque didn't even it didn't even interest me in the beginning. I was like the guy's girl, and I, you know, did a lot of dance and hip hop, and I always liked the guys' part. I always liked being the rough one or the dominant one. And so that's kind of naturally in my persona, in my stance. So I don't think it was far-fetched from anybody to be like, oh, NJ's going to, you know, do the guy part. And I'm like, yeah, that's going to be me. As far as like, I don't know, I always do the voice. I always kind of do the stance. I played guys many times on stage because they know I can do it. So that part wasn't hard. It was just kind of like, okay, this is my second self. I'm going to, you know, do this role. But I don't know, I've got these big boobs, so you can't hide very well. So that's why it kind of turns into a joke sometimes.
I think something that's like really nice about burlesque is that it's a very inclusive form of like sexual expression, like stripping or certain other kinds of, like if you're actually at a strip club, like there's a lot more discrimination that happens and like anti-queerness and anti-fatness and, you know, anti-blackness. And it's very much like, burlesque creates that space and is like very inviting of everybody who is excluded in the typical, I guess, like strip club world. If we're thinking about like burlesque as kind of being a version of stripping, I mean, how do you feel about like the, I guess, the differences? You know, like where do you see the differences beyond just like inclusivity in, I guess, like club stripping versus burlesque stripping?
Well, I celebrate those differences because I think, I don't want to say that they're both needed, especially with the discrimination as far as like you know, club stripping. But I think that's why burlesque kind of has that, they come have a little bit of different origin as far as like inclusivity, because a lot of the most famous, most well-paid burlesque artists are big girls, and they are Black, and they're queer. And a lot of the people who I know have, who have gotten into burlesque since I have or before I have, were people who were repressed. They were people who were like going through things, and they used burlesque as something to break out into. And most of the people are people who celebrate those differences in people and kind of want to see it. They, you know, want to see how you do your sexy thing. And that's why I kind of like being on the burlesque side, because of those, the discrimination. I mean, every group has their problems, and there's people who are like, I don't know, show jealousy or, I don't know, elitism, or is like, I'm a little bit better, but I think that you can find that in most any group.
Yeah, but do you feel like there's much, I guess, like segregation in like the burlesque world? Like, are there like white troops or, you know, very specific, like, you know, people who are more privileged, like gathering in a specific kind of troupe? Or do you feel like it is like very like kind of equal opportunity across the board?
Honestly, I did feel like that in the beginning, that there were troupes who were very specific about what they were looking for, and that they kind of wanted their girls to look all the same and have that same kind of feel. And so it's like, okay, I know I wouldn't be working with them because I'm, you know, a bit thicker, or because I'm, you know, a darker tone or something like that. But after a while, there seemed to be a lot more troops that pop up that didn't care about that. That was like, okay, you're a good artist, you do a good show. And so I just kind of forgot about those other troops. But yeah, like I was saying, I think there's going to be people who separate themselves all the time. I think there's a big separation between the regular or the classic burlesque versus neo burlesque, and they don't really mix as well. But I mean, yes, but at this point, with all the work that I'm doing and people who I guess, know about me enough to offer me shows and things. I'm like, okay, well then I don't need you.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's like something about like, sorry.
No, go ahead.
There's something about like, I don't know, the older style burlesque that just like feels kind of dusty. You know, a little shade, not too much shade though. Don't hold it against me. But I don't know, like there's this one like famous restaurant bar in like Hollywood that has like regular nightly burlesque shows, and it's like this big like celebrity hangout spot, but they all do like the old style burlesque. It's all like the feathers and lace and sequin and gloves and all of that stuff, and it was just like, this is kind of weird, like you're like old timey but like not, but I'm like, I don't know, it just felt so in between genres, like what are you doing, like what's the shtick here.
I feel that. And it's so funny because I talk about this all the time with my current artists and burlesque friends, is where we would go to other shows and stuff. But I'm like, okay, another glove strip. How many different ways can you take off a glove?
And, yeah, exactly.
And it seems way more about the outfit and how great they look. And they look amazing. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, I'm like, okay, so what's this, you know, sparkly outfit about? I'm like, I need more. I need more when I'm watching burlesque to be interested. I mean, that's for me personally, but I think that's just because I do it and I've seen so many shows.
Mm-hmm.
And that that classic style, I think, is important to keep around because it's where it all, I mean, it's a touch to like where it all came from. Mm-hmm. But I know me, I personally, I know I get bored.
Yeah, it's like we're not everybody's like a friggin' Josephine Baker out here, you know? It's mostly,
and even then she danced like she had personality. True. She'd make faces, and even some of her stuff did have story. I'm like, that's something I think I require now. I'm like, well, what's the connection, what's the story? Nothing. You're just smiling and walking back and forth and dropping an item.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
I'm more interested. I'm like, okay, let's see your fan work. But I mean, I know how to work fans, so I'm like, impressed.
Yeah. It's like, are you doing the work or is the prop doing the work?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a good one.
What do you think that the future of burlesque holds? Like, we're in this new era of, you know, sort of the everyman's burlesque.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are y'all going to end up on the metaverse on Oculus Rift?
I don't know. Well, honestly, with us going more online and kind of burlesque artists being more free on like TikToks and things like that, and how TikTok has kind of exploded to expose you to what different people's everyday life is like, I think it's gonna go more that way. And people with like different experiences and people with different disabilities or difficulties with how they live are gonna come out through burlesque, because that's how it's kind of starting now. And those are the things that are interesting, because you're like, oh, I didn't know this before. People are really interested in information and seeing how other people live, I think. So I think that's where it's going to go. I think it's going to be more art, more storytelling twisted into burlesque. But, and that appeal that'll keep people coming is the whole, okay, well, I'm going to see some tits and learn some shit.
Definitely. How do you think new people who want to be in burlesque can start to learn about it or, you know, yeah,
how to begin. How to begin?
Yeah.
Go see burlesque. Go see burlesque, and I think it's also a spiritual journey as far as creating your persona and knowing what you want to do. Maybe you're interested in the classic style. Maybe you want to be shining on stage and just have a bunch of eyes on you, or maybe you want to tell a story. But even telling a story, I think you have to learn after doing. So I think I just, and that's why I think it's also a spiritual journey, because I think you need to discover whether you're willing to put in that time and that money that we were talking about before, because you are your own artist. We're all, we don't have someone, you know, buying us stuff for us. I mean, well, maybe later on down the line, but you have to be willing to make the decision if you're going to invest time and money in yourself to show yourself in the way that you want to be shown, because it's about presenting something to that audience. This is about telling that story and using the right things or the right props or costumes to present yourself.
Do you find that there's like very much like financial relationships, like sugar relationships that happen with burlesque? And I'm also just curious, like, do you, like, what about the financial aspect of it? Is anybody really able to like make a decent living off of burlesque?
Honestly, I mean, I don't think, not unless you're like Dee Devon Tees and you have like a merchandise and line of things. It kind of reminds me of like music artists, where they don't really make money off their music. They make money off their name and what they put their name on, because people like their music. A lot of really successful burlesque artists aren't the ones who, they're not making that much money from their acts. I mean, they get paid like a stipend or two to cover the cost of like travel and stuff, but they don't really, they're not sitting on their, you know, money unless they kind of merchandise themselves, unless they market themselves on different things. So I think, well, I think a lot of us are making enough to cover our cost and to have like, you know, some gas money here and there, because I think we really love it. We really love to do it. Instead of like, oh, well, it's making me all this money.
Yeah, I think that, I don't know, like, I think that that tends to kind of be, for some people, like, the dividing line with sex work is, like, like, how much of it is paying bills and how much of it is love, you know?
I mean, but, like, also, I was doing, you know, sex work, quote unquote, on the side. I still had like a day job. And I mean, a part of it was love, like for the thing, but also like it was supporting me even that little bit. I mean, you know, I guess it depends on like where you fall on the.
I can agree with that, because sometimes you'll spend. No, I was saying I can agree with that, because I think a little bit does help, because, you know, sometimes you get a little gas money, or you can pay for, you know, a meal with just a little bit that you got. Because I'm thinking about like, you'll spend like a certain amount of money on an outfit or an act. And once you have the act, you may not need to spend any more money on it to continue putting it up. But if you do it here, you do it there, you do it a few places, you've made money back on that, on the investment that you put into it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. And I know even like there are strippers, there are doms, there are, you know, different kinds of sex workers who'd still hold a, you know, their therapist or their doctors or their, you know, as well. And they're still sex workers, you know, they're, I don't know. So, oh, and it just disappeared like that. I haven't had a lot of sleep.
It's all good.
Oh, no.
It's all good. I mean, I have not either.
Do you get enough sleep?
It varies. I'm definitely kind of like an extremist with my time. Either I have no time at all, or I have all the time in the world, and then I'm wishing I was back to running around like a chicken. So that's why I did decide I was going to take the month of January and chill out. I was like, I'm not going to do any shows. So I'm not doing any shows right now, But a lot of people are hitting me up about, okay, so come February, you're going to be doing this and this and this. So I know once February comes, I'm probably going to be not sleeping like you guys. but yeah, you definitely have to take time for yourself, because once you're in that world, or in a few different worlds where you're kind of like, you know, working for yourself, yeah, you'll find yourself less sleeping.
Yeah.
What do you say? Like, I decided not to work for someone else and I became my own employer, and then I don't sleep at all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like, I thought I would work less working for myself, but now I work every day.
Yeah.
Do you have specific aftercare that you do for after you've performed?
Ooh. Yes. I usually find the most greasiest fat, you know, heartburn-inducing place nearby to gorge myself, because I haven't eaten all day when I'm preparing for an act or a show. That's especially if I'm like nervous or it's new or something like that. Mm-hmm. I usually don't eat on the day. And so afterward, I'm like ravenous. And I usually go to Fat Sal's. I don't know if you guys know the place, but the place that puts like buffalo sauce and French fries on heroes. Mm-hmm. And I gorge myself. When I come home, I do a really, really slow time of taking off my clothes and getting rid of my makeup, slathering myself in a bunch of different oils and things like that, showering, a bath, and I get someone to rub my feet or two.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, we are kind of coming up on the end of our time. Where can we find you in the world? And is there anything that you'd like to plug?
Oh, well, you can find me on Instagram. That's Dominique-Tricks. And I post all the different things that I'm going to be doing in February, actually. Burlesque and Chill going back online, and we're doing our 70s mating game. It's kind of like the old dating game.
Cute.
And we're all going to be in our living rooms, and it's going to be live.
Awesome.
It's going to be the first Saturday of each month that we're going to be doing Burlesque and Chill.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Nice. You can find me under your bed.
Great.
Just sleeping. Not spooking, just sleeping.
Just taking a break.
Yeah.
You can find me, Selena the Stripper, on Instagram at Pretty Boy Girl. You can check out my Patreon at The Real Pretty Boy Girl. I've finally overcome my writer's block, and I have a very fun story that I will be posting over this week and next week. So stay tuned.
Ooh.
For that. Nice. Yeah, it's going to be about a man whose nickname is the Nose Guy.
Ooh, so curious. That's a teaser. Yes.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode.
Yes.
I don't know why I said it that way, but I did. So that's it.
I appreciate it. I like it.
Have a fantastic week.
Yes.
And yeah.
Stay safe.
Stay safe. Stay sexy.
Yes, that's what I'm telling everyone. Stay safe. I will have a good week for the well wishes kind of.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.